Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You will also see, hopefully, where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight I have a special treat. I have a historical fiction writer by the name of Ed Pretzel on the show. He earned his master's degrees in English literature, creative writing from the University of Missouri at St. Louis, and his bachelor's in English at the University of Hawaii, West Oahu. Ed had a dual career for over 20 years, working as an investments advisory manager for Fortune 100 firms, including Wells Fargo Advisors, MetLife, and Merrill Lynch, while writing screenplays and novels. He was a whistleblower against a corrupt commodities futures brokerage in a case documented in the Wall Street Journal. Ed's expertise as a novelist and screenwriter is in the American tragicomedy movement, which includes, among others, Faulkner, Twain, Tennessee Williams. He also is a novelist in the area of science fiction, Shakespeare, and a variety of historical periods, including World War II, the American Civil War, and 14th century Europe. The final two novels of the Lies That Bind trilogy include the same characters as the original. The two upcoming ones are The Honor Among Outcasts, set in Missouri during the transition from the Civil War to a violent Reconstruction, and Something in Madness, set in California as Dirksen and Antoinette become the tumultuous state's embattled first couple. Ed is married and lives in St. Louis, where he writes full-time and teaches college English. And so I'd like to introduce Ed. Ed, once again, how are you doing tonight?
Very well, David. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I was a little bit thrown for a minute because my intro didn't play, and that was the reason for the pregnant pause. But you never know what's going to happen with technical issues. So.
Sure.
Just need to go with the flow. Well, I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about your background to start off, and so I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Well, my background is a little bit unusual. I have had a Jewish father and a Cherokee mother. Not many of us around in that combination. But my parents divorced when I was in the second grade, so it got a little traumatic for me. I lived for a time in an orphanage until my father remarried, and even later I was a teen runaway. So, I think, as we talked before, David, my background, I think, gives me special insights into creating characters who are outsiders, who are really, in some ways, isolados, people who feel alienated from society. I have a lot of sympathy with them and empathy with them. So it's really affected my writing, but if you read The Lies That Bind, all these characters are really outsiders in their own way, and they're all seeking community. They may be oppressed, but they're seeking their inner spirituality and seeking their own destiny, their own highest aspirations.
Well, is it about? Go ahead, please.
No, go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask you what it is about The Lies That Bind and how it's socially relevant today.
All right. How about if I give you a little bit of a synopsis of the story so people will know what we're talking about when we talk about
that? That would be great.
Oh, okay, David. That'd be great. Well, The Lies That Bind is a twisted tale of intrigue in the antebellum South, but a lot more, too, David. The story takes place in a small Mississippi hamlet right before the start of the Civil War in 1859. The main character, Dirk Hurst, is part visionary, part charlatan. He's on the run, and he escapes into the Mississippi wilds, where he encounters a dozen hungry slaves stranded there. So these people are all desperate. Together, they agree to build their own egalitarian plantation, which they call Dark Horse. So that's the strange setup that sets these people together that are very different. Now, to survive, Dirk acts as the master to hoodwink the town, and his partners pretend to be his slaves. But remember, they're all equal. Big Josh is the real leader of Dark Horse because he once ran a plantation for his former master, a drunk. Also, he's the group's peacemaker, which these are very different people. They really need a peacemaker. Unfortunately, Dirk is ambitious, and Big Josh fears that his schemes may doom them all to the hangman's noose. Now, the town is dominated by the French family. That's a family of two. Mrs. French is a recluse, a widow. From her dark room, she manipulates the region's bankers and cotton brokers, everyone except her frail, rebellious heir apparent, Devereaux. Now, people call Devereaux the loneliest man on earth. In fact, he is driven by unbearable loneliness to mad acts, threatening to expose the family's own dark past, which would prove fatal to their empire. So you see, everyone in this story is weaving a web of lies just to survive. And everyone has a dark past, incidentally, which we learn about as the story reveals their secrets. So that's the basic setup, and it's a bit unusual. I don't want to give you an idea that there are a lot of ideas in the book, David, but it's really very entertaining as the stories tangle webs of deceit unravel. The story's loaded with plot twists and revelations, a lot of humor and irony as well, and it all shines a fresh light on what it means to be a man or a woman, to be free or enslaved. In fact, what it means to be human. So the question is, can these people break free of the lies that bind them to seek their highest aspirations? And that's what the book's about, David.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, that's a whopper, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's going to lead to some more questions down the line, but I want to hear more about the book. So how do you believe that is socially relevant today?
Well, I think it's relevant for all time because this Dark Horse plantation, this equality of these people that are outsiders, is kind of a mythology. It stands for all people in all societies. But it's relevant today because, first, there's race in it. You have men of different races, in fact, slaves and a free man, trying to learn to adapt to each other and form a community and form relationships just to survive. And that's kind of symbolic of the human race, I think. Also, there's gender in it. The French family, you'll find them very interesting. I can't give you all their secrets, but they are concealing some real powerhouses, I believe. And race, gender, class is in it. The Frenches are so powerful, everyone's afraid of them. The whole town's terrified of them. And in fact, I mentioned Devereaux. Devereaux, the people in town called Devereaux the loneliest man on earth. And part of the reason for that is people are so terrified of his mother that they keep him at a distance. So he doesn't have friends. He doesn't have relationships. And his loneliness is a strong drive in this book In fact, Devereaux, who's so wealthy and has all these slaves, he's so lonely, he's envious of his slaves because they have families and friends and so forth. So communities in there. And one thing that's relevant today, all these people are striving in a very difficult world. And I think that's what most people go through in their lives. You know, I think that's pretty universal for us, David.
Sure, I do too. Did you do a lot of research for the book, Ed?
Yeah. I should say, David, that I'm a big history buff, and especially the Civil War. But also, you know, you've mentioned that my major was in literature and so forth and so on. I really have read a lot of Southern literature, especially. And my main writer, my favorite writer, would be William Faulkner. And so as far as researching the book goes, one great book that your readers might want to read is called The Slave Community, which really turns the Southern stereotypes of slaves inside out. And it's a very well-researched book by a man, he's dead now, his name's Blasingame, James Blasingame. But part of the emphasis behind the book was you read especially Southern literature, or especially older Southern literature, and the slaves are stereotyped, the women are stereotyped or ignored. Probably the greatest American novel ever written, William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom. The main character, well, he's legendary, he's emblematic of the South. He builds this great plantation. But what about the slaves he has? It's just completely ignored. It's all about him. So, for example, I took that whole situation for this novel and turned it inside out. Okay, what if the master that everyone respects so much, that everyone's so intimidated by, is just one of many, and really the brains of the outfit is a slave? Now, you mentioned the research on that. Historically, there were slaves that ran plantation for their dissolute masters. And that's what Big Josh is in this, the peacemaker and the real leader, the fellow that really knows how to run a plantation. And there are other examples. Another character that you'll find that's interesting in that group in Dark Horse is Isaac. I call him Angry Isaac. Isaac was so badly treated that he escaped, and he's living as a swamp rat when he joins the group. Well, there were a number of slaves that escaped and were living on the outskirts of civilization. These were called Maroons. So this is all from research. And there are other things in the book that you really enjoy that really give a lot to the story. For example, being a history buff and reading a lot of history, I knew a lot about what the cotton markets did before the Civil War and during the Civil War. So when our hero, Dirk Hurst, who's very ambitious, very vainglorious, decides that he gets the idea from his partners, it's not his idea, that they should perhaps speculate in the cotton markets, then I had a lot of that to fall back upon. And that affects the story because the richest family in town, the Frenches, especially Devereaux French, is on the other side of his trade secretly in the cotton markets. So you have a clash of the most powerful and really the least powerful people in town, the establishment and the outsiders. And one of the places they're doing battle is in the cotton markets. So that's modern day ideas worked into there. You talk about relevancy, but right today we have cotton futures markets, commodity futures markets, stock futures markets, and that's what these people are dealing in. This stuff goes back a couple hundred years, you know. So there are a lot of ideas. To summarize, there's a lot of ideas in the book that are relevant today, and as people read about these people that lived 150 years ago, they'll say, oh, that relates to my life. And I think your readers will be quite surprised at it. And that's what mythology is. You read Greek mythology. You may notice that a couple of section titles are Greek mythology based. That mythology has something. It's not just stories. It's stories that mean something to people. So. A man flying too close to the sun and crashing to earth, etc., all through mythology, throughout history. By the way, I've mentioned mythological terms. There's little cute things like the county seat, which is where the big cotton markets are. They only show up there once or twice in the book, is named... it's called Lathe Creek County, and Lathe Creek is the River Lathe was the river that took people in Greek mythology from when they died from Earth to the underworld, to Pluto and so forth, and to really to hell. So,
I've forgotten that.
Yeah.
I have to brush up on my mythology, Ed.
Yeah. It's just, I put a little gem or two in there just to tickle people a little bit, you know. It's where the big money is. It's where the big cotton money markets are, and I called it Lathe. You know, it's kind of just for amusement.
Well, what motivated you to write the book?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, David. As you mentioned before, or perhaps we haven't mentioned, I wrote a number of screenplays when I was living in Los Angeles, and helped develop scripts for projects for 20th Century Fox and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The Lies That Bind was a screenplay I wrote, and I put it aside and I moved back to St. Louis. But the story, there was just so much meat there, and I think it's really a good concept. You know, it sets up some real drama that I couldn't get it off my mind. So at some point, I said, well, I'm going to write a couple novels now that I'm in St. Louis. And when I went looking for a story, I had a story. There's so much meat in that story that I said, I got all these great characters, all these great ideas. I've got to develop that into a novel. So this is over 10 years in the making, considering I was working and writing on weekends and so forth and so on. And so when I went to write a novel, my first one had to be The Lies That Bind, because it just had the most possibilities. And then, of course, as I wrote the novel and as my mind stretched out, my mind stretched out, but also the characters grew and became people, and they kind of took over the story. So there's a lot of things in the book that surprised me, too, and even minor characters that sprung up when I was writing the book, and they're so delightful. If we read a little scene, I've got a character named Ellen, which all your readers will love. She is an adolescent approaching womanhood, but she's a total innocent, plain, naive. She lives by herself and her grandfather, who's a senior deacon of the church, a very stern, pious, uncompromising man. And she only appears in four scenes in the book. She wasn't in the original screenplay. But she almost brackets the book spiritually because of she is totally naive, and her schemes and plans are often really funny and ironic. But if I read you this little scene, you'll kind of get the idea. But something special is there.
Okay.
You want me to read it now?
Sure. Sure.
You want me to read
this
scene
handy?
Now? Yeah, sure do. I got it right in front of me. Actually, I'll read you two short little scenes, and they're just a couple minutes all together.
Okay.
When they make this deal to form this plantation, Dirk promises his partners that he's going to get them manumission papers. Those are papers that make a slave free. So after they're set up a little bit, he goes into town and he does sign papers. Now he gets these papers at where Ellen lives. Ellen, they own something called the Honor Store. The audience will get a big laugh out of that because it's just totally impractical place. Her grandfather's interested only in religion, and she has no knowledge. She makes up the prices of things based on the mood she's in that day. And now Ellen, she also can scrounge for a few dollars to survive by keeping the town records. So when he goes to get the manumission papers, he gets them from Ellen. The interesting thing is that Ellen and her grandfather are the only abolitionists in town. And people tolerate them because, really, their whole life is devoted to charity for the town's poor people. Okay, so in this scene, now Dirk has gone to get the papers signed to make his partners free, supposedly. Actually, he doesn't own them, so technically, if anybody caught on to that, they'd be in real trouble. They wouldn't be free. He'd probably get hung. So when he's in there, now Ellen, she's getting older. She's becoming a woman a little bit. She, in secret, when her grandfather's in church all day, she makes a dress for herself she calls Lilith's gown. That's from the Bible, Lilith in the Bible. And she considers it risque, but it's just this outfit that maybe outsiders would consider ridiculous, but nobody's ever seen her in her because she keeps it hidden in a shift robe. So when Dirk shows up to get the paper signed, she's wearing that outfit. She's got the whole place to herself that day, and she goes out and lets him see it. And then she's so excited that she's actually freeing people, because the Frenches never free any of their slaves, that she gets so excited, and she's wearing this gown, she runs up and she gives Dirk a kiss, and then she runs out of the room and disappears, never comes back, so Dirk takes the papers and leaves.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty. There's a lot of crazy stuff in this book. It's not all drama and serious. All right, this is Dirk now. On the road, Dirk imagined his partner's gleeful celebration. They were free men, legally non-chattels, if no one examined the situation closely. But as Dirk thought about it, he realized it would be a quiet, bittersweet moment, a cold comfort for them. In their vulnerable situation and sitting on land coveted by everyone in Turkle, especially by the Frenches, Big Josh's admonition that they must keep their freedom status a secret made sense. They'll be free men pretending to be slaves. This realization deflated him. The irony was, if someone like Mr. French had signed the papers, Hearst partners would be in the clear, able to do whatever they chose. Unfortunately, it was Hearst who had signed, and though his partners could now be considered free, through some leap of faith or twist of imagination, they couldn't reveal it to anyone. The charade would have to be maintained, and Hearst couldn't see the end of it. Yet, he figured if he ended up hanged or imprisoned or run off, at least Big Josh, Isaac, Little Turvey, and the rest could pull out these papers to complicate the situation. They could have some kind of a chance. They could say he had misled them. Besides, the girl hadn't charged him the dollar. Okay, now we go back to the honor store. In her room, the senior deacon's granddaughter lay face down on the bed, crying in fits. After almost half an hour, she was able to rise weakly, utterly shaken, to remove and hide Lilith's gown. Then she put on her nightdress and took to her bed with feverish trembling. After dark, her grandfather returned from the church. When he smelled no supper cooking, he hurried into her room, only to find her in bed, claiming she was sick. It seemed forever before he quit asking if he could help and departed, closing her door. His arrival had opened her nerves again. On the one day she had been granted dispensation from her little life to actually free a dozen of God's creatures, she had to spoil the whole august event by wearing the harlot gown. And to top it off, she had dishonored the honor store. She knew she was bound for hell. It was the most confusing thing that ever happened, and at the same time, the greatest tragedy of her life. Then she received divine guidance. The idea came to her like heaven's light and filled her every pore with soothing warmth, like a warm bath. Yes, there was one way to redeem herself, to do so in full. She was only grateful that at last she knew what that one desperate act would be, knew what ultimate sacrifice would be required of her. Her plan would take time and some degree of subterfuge and risk, but she steeled herself for all that. There were many women in the Bible who had done bad, even using their womanliness, to do good in the service of the Lord's purposes in eternity. For the first time in her constricted life, she knew she was destined to be one of those women, to be his instrument. She only wondered why the idea had never occurred to her before. It was almost as if her encounter with a stranger had been a sign. Of course, the question of hell still stood between her and her objective. She was certainly going to have to endure much, much more than a single kiss. But if God meant her heroism to be rewarded with hellfire, well, she was nonetheless determined to sacrifice her immortal soul to fulfill her quest. Besides, would God punish a girl for doing his will? Yes, she would free all the slaves in Turkel. She didn't know how one converts seduction to manumission, but that clean-shaven Mr. French was just the king she needed to be her instrument and God's. And Lilith's gown had been the inspiration and the catalyst.
Wow.
This is just her getting the idea when she shows up in the book at the oddest times, with the oddest plans. It's just sad and tragic and lovely. She's just a darling, and there's a lot of characters in the book I think the people will like. Even the characters that are really kind of rough. Mrs. French, now the recluse that dominates and controls the town. She's completely cut off spiritually. She has shut her spiritual needs down as much as she can, and when they rise up, they hurt her. They pain her heart. But as the story goes along, David, you learn about how she got where she was not born wealthy. She was born totally poor in New Orleans. How she got to run a whole county. You learn about all the hurt she'd taken in her life, all the emotions she'd had in her life. And actually, the stories like that, all the characters, as you move forward, as the story moves forward in time, and we have all these twists and turns and surprises, you also learn more and more about what happened in their past. And so that the revelations show what the people really are made of, and that they're not stereotypes. And that's kind of what I was going against in the book, the stereotypes. For example, and one thing I want to tell you about, you have Dirk, who's this, well, he's kind of loosey-goosey. He's tried a lot of visionary schemes, but he's really a charlatan, too. He hoped to get rich on all of them. But you have this man who's cut loose from society, who feels alone, who has no friends. He has no money when he meets them. He's been betrayed a number of times in his life. Then you have these men that have been slaves. And because of intimidation, the lash, so forth, they've not been able to speak their point of view. In fact, this book I mentioned, The Slave Community, if the lash was a consequence and a management device, you'd be pretty careful about what you said. And so these fellas, pardon?
I said, I bet.
yeah, I'd be a real good person.
Yeah.
And I'd be real quiet. But now that they're all partners, they get their chance to speak their mind. And actually, Isaac, the one who was badly treated and ran away and was living in the swamp, the maroon, he's a very good catalyst for this group because he doesn't trust anybody. He's very distrustful of people. He's been badly treated by the human race. So he speaks his mind, and it's very powerful. No matter what anybody comes up with, he's against it. So he gets the pot going, and then people see him speaking his mind. The other partners see him speaking his mind, and they become open to speaking their own mind. So these are people that have never got to speak their mind relating to power, relating to empowering themselves, are finally getting to do that. So that is a whole, that's why I say Dark Horse, the plantation Dark Horse, is a mythological area where people finally come free and finally get to speak their minds. And it's really a special thing.
And, which of the characters do you relate to most, Ed?
Oh, which character I don't relate to? I don't know. I'll be honest with you, David. All these characters are part me. They're all a piece of me. From the worst one, from Mrs. French sitting in a dark room, shutting out the world, really just controlling her son and wanting him to do things that might even destroy him, and shutting her heart to her children and her grandchildren, to little Ellen, who's a total idealist and doesn't know any better, to Dirk, who's a charlatan and a bit of a visionary. I've always thought I was a bit of a visionary. And, you know, I'd mentioned my past that I started off, I had this divorced parents and I was separated from my mother and all that. You know, not everybody starts, and I think your readers will sympathize with this, not everybody starts as, not everybody starts with an idealized situation. There's a lot of people out there that start with a lot of strikes against them, perhaps a lot of trauma. And so you always talk about spirituality. Some people, it's a very hard road to find their spirituality, to find themselves. And I think my characters fall in that category. And the group in Dark Horse, they not only have to learn themselves, but they also have to learn about each other and learn to adjust to each other and find community where there was no community. There's no rules for them, no models for them. So, you know, it's like we're all individuals and we have to seek something that is greater than ourselves. And Dirk's never had anything greater than himself. And so I do like Dirk quite a bit. He's a good character. But they're all really fine. I have to say, Devereaux French, the loneliest man on earth. Well, we've all gone through periods of loneliness. And Devereaux, he is trapped in a situation. And you'll have to read the book to see what that is. I'm not going to give it away.
No, I wouldn't expect you to do that. Why do you think some people can overcome the darkness and live in the light and others can't?
Well, I think we all have that aspiration towards that, David. And that's a really good question. I think, related to this book, everybody is living a lie to get by. And I think in our real lives, we lie to the world, we lie to ourselves. And we've all done it, me as well as anybody else. But I think the reason people can do it is because if you go into your heart and find your true aspirations, what you truly are, then perhaps you can break free of the lies. And that's what all these characters are trying to do. They're trying to break free of these lies that they've made up, the lies that they're living and the lies that they're telling themselves. So I think some people, you know, everybody can do that, and everybody is set on doing it. Everybody needs community just to be safe. Some people can't break through, and they may try to break through, but some people can't really break through because they're afraid, I think. They lock themselves in a safe place, and they're afraid to break through. And that's really hard. And sometimes you need to be lucky. You need to find someone who you love and who loves you. And maybe over time, maybe you'll even hurt that person, and maybe they'll hurt you. But maybe over time, that will give you the courage to break through the lies and the trap you've put yourself in and break through and find some kind of truth for yourself. And I'm sure with your listeners, you know, it's a lifelong journey. You're a spiritual adventurer, and it takes a lot of courage. The thing is, if people are hurt badly enough, they have trouble finding that courage, and especially if they're driven into loneliness, to being isolated. But like my characters are, and I think one good thing about this book, they all try to find happiness, and it's a hard thing to do. It's a lifelong struggle and a lifelong journey. But what else is there, David?
absolutely. Well, hopefully that's the motivation for all of us to find our way and embrace our bliss and embrace the truth within us and move forward in a positive direction. What surprised you most about the development of your story?
As I mentioned, I started off really with a concept, this partnership, because it created such a situation for drama and so forth. But then all the characters I put into it, they they discovered their own lives and they went their own way. So the story kind of wrote itself in some ways. You know, I put a lot of twists and obstacles and so forth and so on. But still, these characters had to find their own spirituality. People that never trusted each other were going to have to learn how to trust each other. In fact, people that have never trusted anyone were going to have to learn to trust just to survive. On the other side, the Frenches, the wealthy family, they a similar situation. Devereux French, who is really the second major character in the book, the one that I said is the loneliest person on earth, Devereux is just devastated by loneliness and trapped by his mother. And when the book opens, his mother she realized Devereux's going out of his mind. She adopted a child for him, or got a child to adopt for him, but the child has died. So when the story begins, Devereux realizes he is trapped in total loneliness, total desperation. I'll tell you about a little scene. There's a scene when Devereux is very young, and he tries to get out of the house and make a friend. And the consequences of that in the story, when his mother catches him, are pretty extreme. And so Devereux, too, needs friendship. And even Mrs. French, who has tried to quiet all the spirituality within her, trying to shut it down, she's wants to live. Now, she has trouble escaping and finding spirituality. She has locked herself physically and psychologically and emotionally and in her own room. She's trapped in her own room, in her own mind. And even she has urges towards being a mother. The child dies and she says, go stick him in the ground. You know, he's dead. She had feelings for that child, too, what would be technically her grandchild, her step-grandchild. So there's no villains in this and no heroes in it. They're just people seeking. So did that answer your question, or did I miss part of it, David?
No, that does. That really does. What's the one thing that you most want people to take away from the book?
Oh, well, one thing, it's very entertaining. But over and above that, I think people should take away that no matter how oppressive the situation, no matter how bad your circumstances, there is always hope, and you can beat your circumstances. You can find the truth. And as I said before, you know, you have to learn to be honest with yourself. You may be telling lies to people. You may be living a lie in your own mind. But when people find the truth in their own hearts, when they find their own true aspirations, then life becomes real. You start discovering your happiness and so forth and so on. So I think that's important to do in the book. One thing, for example, Dirk, my main character, one time he realizes they're starting to get successful. People start to look at him, well, he's got a plantation, they're building a mansion, which they're all living in, and there's a woman he loves, he wants to marry her, and he's thinking, someday I'm going to find myself. He says, someday I'm going to be more than just a little squirrel hunting nuts and trying to avoid the wolves of the world. Someday I'm going to wake up and I'm just going to be me. He says, then even if I lose the plantation, even if I lose the mansion, even if I lose the wife, if I lose everything, maybe for the first time in my life, I won't lose myself.
Oh.
Yeah, that's just, when I was thinking about your call coming, I just remembered him thinking about that. So, yeah, and these characters are all trying to find themselves.
Well, it sounds like it. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's a fun read, too. There's a lot of great stuff in there. You'll enjoy Little Ellen.
I liked her from the passages that you read. Sounds like a very complicated little character.
Yeah.
Where can people get your book, Ed?
Okay, well, the book comes out December 8th, and you can go onto my website online. It's edprotzel.com. It's E-D, Ed. Protzel is like pretzel with an O, P-R-O-T-Z-E-L.com. And all you have to do is click on. You'll get on my email list. They'll send you all the details about it. So I'll be able to give you all the places that you can get the book. You could probably get it through Amazon and so forth and so on, just the typical places.
Okay, so what's next for you?
Well, as we mentioned, I'm finishing a book that is more modern. It's a, I'd really call it a mystery thriller type thing, and that is getting pretty close to finish. We're within a couple months of finishing that book. Yeah, the name of the book is The Antiquities Dealer, and I don't want to go into too much detail and give it all away, but it's about a person who's an antiquities dealer in St. Louis, and he even knows he's more at home in the past with his relics than he is in the modern world, but he's very successful. He's built his own antiquities gallery, antiquities shop. He is drawn into a conspiracy by a woman that he was in love with 20 years ago, and by an organization. Well, I will tell you that there is an organization in Israel that claims to be 2,500 or more years old, and there's a project that an old friend of his is in charge of for them. They have a university. Yeah, and it's a fictitious university, and it's a fictitious organization. But he's drawn into a conspiracy of theirs basically to clone the great minds of history. Yeah, and that's all I'm going to tell you about it. It's a real thriller. There's all kinds of interesting characters and organizations in it, and at least three people are out to kill him.
Oh boy!
And there are mysteries involved. So it's like the Liza Bynum, a lot of twists and turns in it.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your writing regimen?
Okay. Well, if I had my choice, I like to write every day, and I just get up and go at it. Once I have a project going, it's fun because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about it all the time. And people say, oh, should you write every day? Well, so you can't write every day because real life interferes. You know, as I mentioned, I'm teaching a little writing out at the university here and so forth. But I recommend to writers that they write every day, because if you don't want to write that day, your mind, and you know this as well as I do, David, your mind will go somewhere else, and it will rebel against the story you're writing, and you come up with things that you never even imagined. Your mind goes into great places. Like, for example, Ellen we talked about. I came up with her on a day I didn't feel like writing the rest of the story, and she added a lot of delight to this book, even though she's only in four scenes. So your mind goes into a lot of places, and the reason my books have a lot of twists and turns, some days the characters they don't want to do what I want them to do, and they go do something entirely different, and I'm as delighted and surprised as the reader. So that's my writing scheme. And, you know, I try to come up with a concept that allows for a lot of possibilities, like this partnership. Boy, that could have gone any direction. Plus the French plantation. Those people are so tangled up in their secret past that could destroy them that anything could happen, especially with Devereaux, the main character in that end, totally tied up in his life and living a horrible life. It's like solitary confinement. So there's that. And then you want to get conflict into every scene. And if you have the right situation, you'll have conflict in every scene. Mainly I look for ambiguity. All the characters have inner conflicts as well. So not only conflicts with each other, but I don't write typical villains too much. But, you know, even the villain wonders, Should I be killing these people? I mean, even a killer might wonder, you know, God, this man has a family. This man has children. You know, I really just had to kill this fellow. So although I don't have people generally that are that cold-blooded, there aren't any cold-blooded killers in The Lies That Bind. But, you know, everybody has ambiguity within them, and
that's true.
I still agree.
Well, do you have any other advice for aspiring writers?
Oh yeah, it just, if you have to write, do it. If you get pleasure out of it, do it. And even if, you know, it takes a lot of, you talk about courage. I'm a coward. I was born a coward. My situation my background made me a bit of a coward. But it takes a lot of courage to know you're going to work on something for a year or 2 years, and you don't know if you're going to make a penny on it. So I would say if you need to write and you're compelled to write and you love writing, just get in and do it. And, you know, everybody's their own worst critic, and sometime when you get things polished the way you want them, get it out there in the world. You know, all they can do is say no, but at least they'll have read it. And on The Lies That Bind, I think till I got it in this version and with this agent and this publisher, I think we were turned down 100 times. It's possible we were turned down 100 times. It would seem like 100 times. Once seems like,
yeah. Well, it's a challenge world out there for a new writer to try to break into the publishing industry, and certainly takes a lot of perseverance, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And I may have been exaggerating with 100 times, but it, like I said, everyone's their own worst critic, and an agent says, well, that's a terrific book, but I don't think I can sell it. Or some agents said, a couple agents said, it's the best book we've ever read, but we can't sell something that takes place in the South. You know, they were New York agents. So
Go ahead.
How important
you thought it was to find an agent.
Well, it's important to me because I'm really a writer, you know. I didn't want to be a marketer and a PR person and all that stuff, and self-publish and so forth and so on. I wanted to get an agent that could handle it so I could spend my primary efforts on writing, which is what I enjoy. And so I thought that was important to me to get an agent. And but there are people that publish their own works that are very successful with it, but they're very good at marketing and so forth. I am not.
Well, the self-publishing industry has really opened up the possibilities for new writers, but as you say, there are a lot of challenges that go along with that, too. And marketing, yeah. I think, is the biggest part of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I was lucky finding the agent I did, Jeannie Loicano. She believed in the story. She believed in me. And I was really quite lucky that she was so perceptive. As I said, there were a couple agents who said, it's the best novel I've ever read, but I don't think I could sell it. Well, she went with her convictions, Jeannie. And to be honest with you, it's an awfully strong story. She found a publisher pretty quickly, but she also found a publisher who believed in the idea and the story, and I hope they all do very well with it.
Well, I hope so too, Ed. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close today?
No, not much. Just enjoy reading The Lies That Bind. It's edprotzel.com, Protzel like pretzel with an O, and keep writing, keep reading, and keep seeking spiritual adventures, and keep listening to David's broadcast.
Well, thank you, and thank you for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best with this book and with your future writing efforts. And thank you for a wonderful hour.
Well, thank you for having me, David. It was a lot of fun, and I've always enjoyed talking to you.
All right, Ed. Well, have a beautiful evening.
You too.
So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.